Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Thanks for joining us today. We've got a great topic lined up again and some great guests in studio today to talk about a very interesting subject. If you heard the promotional piece this week going on, talking about transitioning to seminary life. And we're also going to talk about transitioning out of seminary life into parish life as well today, as we're talking with our friends from PALS, which stands for Post-Seminary Applied Learning and Support, here in the studio. A great crowd packed in, and they so graciously are scrunched in the studio here with me today. We'll introduce our guests in just a moment. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin. If you'd like to find out more about Concordia University, you can visit our website, kfuoam.org. Go to the sponsors section and click on the Concordia University, Wisconsin logo there, and you can find out more. It'll take you right to their website and learn about all that they have to offer, including their support of this show, Faith and Family, which families are obviously an important part of our Christian life. And we're going to talk about some very important families today here on Faith and Family. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so. If you're in the St. Louis area, you can call at 314-821-0850. Outside of the St. Louis area, you can call us at 1-800-730-2727. Or if you'd like to email a question or comment, you can do that at family@kfuo.org. So welcome to our guests today. In studio, we have with us Pastor Robert and Sheila Foote. Welcome to KFUO today.
And I think my mic is off. Oh,
there we go. Sorry.
Okay.
All right. And we also have Pastor David and Kathy Ludwig joining us in the studio today.
Sure. Dave and Kathy.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And also, we have Carrie O'Donnell joining us. She's the PALS coordinator. And so she's here in the studio. And I know she's waiting until the second half. She's got all of it ready and ready to go to talk during our second segment. So welcome.
Glad to be here.
So PALS is Post-Seminary Applied Learning and Support, which is a program primarily designed for pastoral formation. When we talk about pastoral formation, we're talking about the shaping and not just education, but what that word means, formation, what it means to become a pastor. And certainly seminary education is an important part of that. But as one of my mentors once said, the seminary makes seminarians, the parish makes the pastor. And there's so much truth to that. You learn a lot in seminary. But life in the parish, life in the congregation is really, I think, what makes a pastor and really any church worker for that matter. It's life in the congregation or wherever you're given to serve, whether it's a congregation or institution. That's really when you're called to serve in those ways, that's really what shapes you. So we're going to talk about pastoral formation today, and especially your life experiences, your journeys, and how that went along. So I know that some of our guests have to leave us early today. So during the first segment here, we're going to talk a little bit more with Pastor Dave and Kathy Ludwig about what led up to pastoral formation to you. What was it that led you to consider the seminary and go on from there?
Well, for me, it was a sort of a non-brainer. My grandfather was a pastor here at St. Charles, he was a Lutheran pastor. I had some uncles and aunts work at CPH after being missionaries, and had most of my uncles as pastors, or Friedrichs, and now I came from a family of 12, and most of us are in the ministry, so my father was a pastor, so it was a no-brainer.
So a family of pastors.
Yes.
It's kind of the family business, huh?
Something like that. So I knew I had a call for the ministry early on, and was quite excited to be able to go through the system, Concordia Austin, and then through the senior college at that time, and then the seminary.
And when in the picture did you all get married, Kathy?
Well, I had the privilege of falling in love with this guy that I knew was going to be a pastor, and I was a Lutheran school teacher. We met at Austin, and then I went to what was then River Forest, and we got married the second year at the Sim. And in those days, it was rare. So that was a transition.
And what was that transition like? You followed him, and you get married during second year at seminary. What was that change like, going from being a teacher, a Lutheran educator, and now you're at the seminary as a seminary wife?
Well, I didn't even know my last name, so it was kind of hard to say, this is Mrs. Ludwig, because I was still going by Miss Jacob in my mind. But being a sim wife was exciting, and I think that was part of my growth to be a pastor's wife. And I guess we had a perfect marriage because we never saw each other. We were either working or teaching or going to school.
Yeah, you were teaching here at St. Louis.
Yes, I got my call to St. Louis.
So how long you spent all of second year then at the seminary?
Yes.
And then third year is typically vicarage. Did you go out on vicarage then third year?
Yes, we went to Detroit. Evergreen Lutheran Church at that point, a large congregation, had about close to 90 in our confirmation class.
And I taught at a neighboring church, so we were busy, but
that was a wonderful time.
From the very beginning, your family was very busy, both teaching and studying, and somebody probably worked or somebody provided to pay for the bills too. How did you fit all of that in?
Well, that was my big salary of being a Lutheran school teacher. And, you know, back in those days, the cooks would sneak in food and just...
And we didn't even know we were poor.
you had so many blessings.
Yes.
That you were rich in blessings from the Lord. So you go to seminary, you go on vicarage in Michigan, and then come back for fourth year, right, at the seminary?
Well, I was somewhat unusual because I got a call to come and take a second vicarage to Concordia Senior College in Fort Wayne. So I actually taught pre-seminary students there who were about 3 years younger than I was. That was a very interesting year.
So you had a bit of an unusual experience. You get to go teach then at the senior college. And then what happened? So you're kind of all over the place, St. Louis, Michigan, now
right.
Fort Wayne. And then did you come back to St. Louis after that?
Yes, with a little boy. So we had another addition to our family.
So the family's growing. Your knowledge is growing from all your studying and your experience.
Right.
Back in St. Louis for fourth year.
And we did have more partners and marriage, you know, more couples. But I think back, and that's what Piles has to offer. We did not have a big community. We didn't have a community of seminary wives getting together. And so
we were sort of isolated in a lot of ways.
So that's why we just love the gift of Piles, that we can be supportive and helping our new pastors learn.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So then from fourth year, then you receive your first call, correct?
Well, no, I went on and got my PhD at WashU.
Okay.
And then my first call was actually back to the senior college to teach.
Okay.
Be a professor there.
So you spent some more time here in the St. Louis area studying.
Yep.
and preparing to go on. And then after that, then you finally go out to serve after all that studying. And you thought it's going to be a breeze from here, right?
Oh, well, I had no idea what it would be like.
So
the transitions were very interesting, put it that way.
So as a pastor professor,
yep.
What was life like then for you in that first call, in that first position, life in Fort Wayne, getting settled in? Kathy, what was that like?
Well, by that time, we had two little boys and not much in our bank account, and like every family, a place to live. And we were privileged to have a support group because we had a faculty, but we were always involved in ministry. We always had vacancies, and so we felt like we were a parish pastor in addition to mm-hmm. Dave's teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And now he is a parish pastor in retirement, so we continue to have that gift.
What were the types of support that you gained? You said you had support there, you know, a network of support or community of support. What was it that was so helpful to you?
Well, we had a faculty, and like at the seminary in Fort Wayne now, they kind of lived together. We lived off campus, but they had that support of, you know, we had babies, and everybody helped each other when you needed, and we shared babysitting and things like that. We had book clubs and ways to friendships.
Unlike a lot of pastors who go out into a parish, a lot of times they become much more isolated. They don't have the collegiality of a sort of close-knit faculty. And they sometimes are in a rural or a setting where they're not pastors very close. So it's a very different transition for so many of them. And that's really what PALS is all about.
Sure.
To help so many of them who don't have a very, a support system as they get out.
Right, right. So when you got settled in Fort Wayne, you certainly had the support of other faculty. You had the the support of not just the faculty, but their families as well. Your families interacted, it sounds like. And it's more than just an academic type of support. That you really needed.
Well, it was 90% of it was the families getting together, getting to know each other, helping each other. If there's a crisis, there's always someone that you could call or lean on.
But for me, also, one thing I would do over is I think I was so into being perfect like everybody else seemed to be. And it took three little boys and a few years that I realized that I needed time of my own. I needed to be me. And I think that's another thing that PALS, we offer a safe place and a privilege that they will know that we're trustful and that they can share their life, real life.
So PALS really is a network that connects those early years, the pastors and their families during those early years, a couple of times throughout the year, correct?
Yes, you can think of a young pastor going out. The first couple of years in ministry really shapes the habits and the lifestyle and everything else that he will gradually develop along with his wife. And for those years to be troubled or isolated or a pastor begins to get in trouble, in conflict or maybe works too hard or too many expectations. And these things then gradually take the joy out of ministry, and then a good number of pastors after 5 years quit the ministry because of that, a scary number of those. So this is a way of providing in those critical formative years a support system and a way for them to really have support and connection. And so we do meet like 2, 3, 4 times a year and keep in constant email contact, sometimes phone contact, praying, prayer chains, things like that, which provide really a healthy support for them.
And I think these new workers also know that their district is supporting this PALS program, and also their congregation has put energy behind it. And so they know that they're just enveloped with all this support.
So you spent time as a professor, as an instructor, and then as a parish pastor as well, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So where did you go from the senior college then?
Then we went to Hickory, North Carolina, where I was associate pastor, have been for like 35 years, and also still a professor there at a Lutheran university.
So how did that, packing up the whole family and moving now, you said, how many kids did you have by this point in time, did you say?
We had three.
Three.
And they were, yeah. Just at those ages that they didn't want to move. But, so that was another transition. And it wasn't that we wanted to move either. So, but we happened to join a congregation that would have supported any PALS program because they were the ones that were our support.
So how did you make that transition then? You probably felt uprooted, had to start all over again, build those communities.
Yeah, those were very tough years.
Yeah.
Trying to decide, how to reconfigure our lives, a whole different setting. But the support that we got down in Hickory from our congregation was really, really good. And we felt welcomed, and the transition then they made much easier.
And how did they do that? Obviously, PALS wasn't in place yet at this point in time. We didn't have a formal process for this. What were the things that the congregation did or the brothers and sisters in Christ did there to help you feel welcome? Kathy?
Well, we belong to a congregation that 36 years ago welcomed us in, and they welcomed the man from the street into. And we happen to be in a neighborhood that all the homeless live in now, and our congregation has not changed. The atmosphere is come in, be part of us. We also were in a circuit that a lot of fellowship went on, and that was a real support also.
So seeing the welcome from the brothers and sisters in Christ that happened in a number of ways, they certainly welcomed you. What were the ways that they welcomed you? What were the things that really spoke to you that said, we know we're welcome here?
Well, food's always good.
Lutherans love food.
Yeah.
There were a number of pastors who got together regularly, even playing golf and other activities, social activities and things like that, which was very, very helpful back then, which interestingly does not happen anymore.
I think that we felt the safe place that we, again, in PALS want to offer, because I don't think, you have to realize this was 36 years ago, that the culture is the same.
Sure, our culture has changed, but there's always something of human nature is still the same, and by human nature we don't necessarily always reach out to one another, and that's where the work of Jesus at,
well,
in the
my
church
southern was. Friends would say we moved south, you know, and they, but I think prayer and Bible study, we've always had small groups in our church, and. So I think it's not the big crowds, it's the smallness, and that's what we also have in our groups of PALS. It's more intimate and not the big congregation that a lot of them are going into.
It's obvious that having that support that obviously turned into, that has now been formalized in PALS was very important to you, to have that network of support so that you could do the things that you were there, that you were called to do there as a pastor. Without that support, what would your work as a pastor have looked like?
Well, it would have gotten increasingly, let's say, isolated. There's so many demands on a pastor that you can very easily just focus on those demands, on the church, on the things you have to do, and the connections with the brothers, with family, begin to erode.
And when those erode...
Then comes the beginning of burnout. You know, that's when pastors start getting in trouble, they become isolated.
It's hard to carry out those things that you're given to do, that you're called to do. It becomes very difficult. Go ahead.
And I think as sim wives, you know, we think, well, we work and we'll let our husbands study Hebrew, but we'll get them on our first call. And then we get into that situation and it seems like the meetings every night and we see less of our husbands. And so I think wives often suffer more than the husbands because they're still in that honeymoon stage in the congregation. And often the wives are at home or they've had to find another job and another new transition. So, again, to me, that's why I said yes to PALS, is because I know those ladies need each other.
Yeah, your wives so often can't voice some of the things they feel and think because, you know, they have to protect their husband or to feel that they're somewhat in a fishbowl. And so they really honestly need, you know, a place where they feel safe and feel collegiality that helps them from becoming isolated.
Having that network support is obviously important. And during those first 3 years that we've talked about, that PALS can really provide that network is beneficial, and we're starting to see the effects of that now. We're seeing some longevity starting to happen, and pastors being healthy and well-rounded and not feeling as burnt out as quickly. Another aspect of your lives, another venture that you two have been involved in, as we were talking before the program today, beyond PALS, we'll just talk a little bit briefly about this other venture that you've gone into.
Kathy and I have gotten involved with Dr. John Eckridge here in St. Louis in a ministry called Grace Place Ministry. For about the last 8 years, we've worked with many pastors and wives and other professional church workers. And it's the same thing. Try to get them a support system, get them, it's like an oasis that they can come to and look at their lives, develop better connections, keep from being isolated. So it's become a very, very good ministry for us and for the many people that we've worked with.
We've mentioned the word isolated a couple of times. Why is it that church workers, why do church workers feel isolated? Pastors' wives, other church workers. What is it that about that life and that service in the church that seems to leave you feeling isolated?
Maybe we'll leave it to the others. I think some of it is we put it on ourselves also, you know.
It's our human nature.
It's our human nature to try to feel that you have to be the best pastor, or sometimes there's competition within the circuit or all of these things that swirl. And so the holding things private is part of our human nature because we have to protect ourselves. So
sure.
And I think we're so busy serving everyone else that we forget that we need to be served also.
And if I may, there are some burdens that the pastor has to carry alone, you know, for the confidences in the office. And even though the pastor's wife may not know what those burdens are, she certainly picks up on those burdens empathetically.
Mm-hmm. And that comes with the office. Yeah, it comes with the turf. When you step into that, when you take on that responsibility as a pastor, there are burdens that you take with you to the grave that you don't share with anybody else. And I can imagine that does take its toll on you. You can't share it with anybody else. You've got to keep that private. And you're right. I'm sure at home that the missus picks up on that pretty quickly too. Whether you know even when you can't talk about it, those are things that emotionally wear on you. And if your wife knows you well, she's going to know that there's something wearing on you. And again, that I know that happens in our household when I'm stressed about something, whether I say anything about it or not, my wife picks up on it. That's just part of the marriage relationship.
And Grace Place is a ministry to let the professional church workers know how much they are appreciated and to take a pause point in their life and experience that grace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's no secret that the pastors who quit ministry or get burned out become increasingly isolated. It's almost like a circle they start getting into, and gradually there comes a point where they can't break it anymore, and they become depressed and finally either quit the ministry or have a breakdown of some sort.
So PALS, Grace Place, now you're serving as facilitators for PALS. Mm-hmm. Based on all the experience that you've had and your experience as a pastor, you mentioned you're in retirement now but still serving as a parish pastor and also in PALS. What do you, obviously you bring a lot of experience to PALS. What has been for you as being a facilitator for PALS, what is that like getting to share in the lives of young pastors and their families?
Oh, this is fun because you can catch people long before they're burned out. They're in a period of excitement now. And now if you can get the right habits going and get the right, the associations and things like that. That's fun.
And we can talk more about this after the break, too. What are some of those habits that you describe as the right habits?
Oh, the main one is for them to be open with their lives and what's going on so that they don't close up inside themselves and also receive support.
And from a wife's perspective, I hear the gals saying, oh, it's just so nice to be with my husband
and to
worship together and to study God's word together. And then to have time with other wives, maybe even shopping together or having coffee together. It's
I'm sure just to sit in the pew together is kind of nice. I'm sure that can be refreshing as a pastor's family to be able to sit with your wife or to be able to sit with your husband and to receive God's gifts together and enjoy those together. To be able to share a hymnal and sing songs, yes. Sing hymns together.
In our group, we've been taking turns with their passions, and it's amazing. One of them said, oh, I haven't even thought about that since I got married and we've been at the Sim, you know. So we all danced together because she was a dance instructor.
Well, we are having a great time talking today with our friends from PALS here at Post-Seminary Applied Learning and Support about transitions in life for those who are called to serve in the Office of Holy Ministry and their families and all the joys and challenges that go with that. We're gonna come back here after the break and talk a little bit more with our other family, with the Foote family, about their transition as well, and find out a little bit more about PALS right here on Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO, the Messenger of Good News.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
The past of late-term abortionist Nicole O'Reilly has caught up with her. The Maryland Board of Physicians permanently revoked her license in a scathing 24-page report. While in the Army, she and others would steal the identities of her fellow soldiers and charge expensive items on the credit cards. She then lied to cover up the incident on her application for a Maryland medical license, even though she pled guilty. But people who take the lives of preborn babies anytime during pregnancy won't think twice about being dishonest. Plus, Riley was an incompetent abortionist. She horribly botched an abortion which jeopardized the woman's future fertility. Pro-abortion activists claim there's only a few who do late-term abortions, but pro-lifers are exposing the truth. There are many more.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
What makes Thrivent Financial for Lutherans a strong financial services organization is what has made us strong for generations. Things like holding firm to our values, keeping our promises, and offering quality products that meet the needs of our members, wherever they are in life. Strong today, strong tomorrow. Committed to meeting your needs. Contact Thrivent Financial today at 314-783-4200. Registered representatives for securities offered through Thrivent Investment Management Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC.
Hello, I'm Rod Zwanitzer, Director of Broadcast for KFUO. We totally depend on the gracious supporters who want this gospel voice to continue and expand as the messenger of good news of Christ. A wonderful part of this support is our underwriters, an ever-increasing number, and so we ask you to find out who they are by checking them out on our website or as you hear them here on KFUO. Write, call, or tell them how much you appreciate their support of Worldwide KFUO.
On His Time, we sanctify your day with the Word of God and prayer. The church year sets our clock. The Word of God feeds our souls and all courtesy of Treasury of Daily Prayer. And we even discuss matters important to you and the whole church. And don't forget to join us for morning prayer every morning right here on His Time.
Weekday mornings beginning at 7 a.m. on KFUO.
A Detroit pastor who's hosting thousands of members of the Progressive National Baptist Convention this week says his bankrupt city deserves help from Michigan's Rainy Day Fund.
We believe that the Bible requires that we stand for justice and that we speak out for justice. So yes, we will pray, but we will also be speaking out to express how unjust we think this is.
The Reverend James Perkins of Detroit's Greater Christ Baptist Church is first vice president of the African American denomination. He says the progressive Baptists are also angry that the Supreme Court struck down part of the Voting Rights Act.
We take that as a slap in the face to the legacy and memory of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was a member of this denomination, and as stewards of his dream for a just America, then we're lifting our voices around that issue.
Perkins believes God will use adversity to unite and energize believers. I'm Steve Coleman.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates, and today we are talking with our friends from PALS, Post-Seminary Applied Learning and Support, about transitions in life, specifically for those who are serving in ministry, for pastors and their families as they make that transition to seminary life and from seminary life into parish life. What does that look like, and is it doable? Is it life that people want to live? You know, as someone's considering going to seminary to become a pastor, is it something that is it a life worth living? I hope so. You're here today. So joining us in the studio is Pastor Robert and Sheila Foote and Carrie O'Donnell, which is also the PALS coordinator. So Pastor Foote, as we were talking during the break about your life and what's going on with pastors, we mentioned that Pastor Ludwig mentioned in the earlier segment that there's a difference in how pastors interact today than what it was like, years ago. What is that difference in how and why do we need pals now?
You know, I'll start off, since David has left, I'll start off by saying that he's much older than I am. Although we've been in ministry close to the same length of time because of his professorialship. But I've been a pastor or a vicar, if you count the vicarage, for about 30 years. And I've noticed that shift also. And I think it's largely a shift in our culture in America that there's so much pressure on pastors, either real or perceived, to really help the church grow, because we know statistically churches have been contracting, at least many churches have been contracting. And I think the pastors are feeling this pressure. And so now they're turning the ministry into something that's a work as opposed to something that's just resting and trusting the Spirit and the Word. And we're letting the world encroach in upon the whole concept of the call.
In a sense, what we would call it in the rest of the world, we call it mission creep,
yeah.
Where we're given a duty, we're given to do something, and then all these other ideas start creeping in, and the pressure, and that's where we fall apart when we can't stand up to and can't uphold all those other things that have creeped into our position. That's where PALS really comes into play and is really helpful and provides a network of support.
And I think it's also a temptation for young pastors also. There's this temptation that, you know, it's the bootstraps Horatio Alger thing. I got to do it myself. And that's completely backwards. You know, what you want to do is equip and lead the congregation to share in the work. And that's why they get burned out.
Sure. And that anytime I hear someone say bootstraps, it always makes me think of Pelagianism and the, you know, you got to pull yourself up and get up there and make that. And when we apply that same thinking to how we go about in service to the church and making disciples, it's not about us. Certainly we are given, but God gives us all that we need to do in order to be the ones who are delivering his good gifts. If you are listening today and you have questions about maybe you're thinking about transitioning to seminary life and thinking, man, this is just really that's a big leap. It certainly is a leap of faith, as our guests here today would, I'm sure, affirm. But if you'd like to join the conversation, have questions or comments, you can call us in the studio here in St. Louis. It's 314-821-0850. Outside of the St. Louis area, 1-800-730-2727, or you can email your questions and comments to us at family@kfuo.org. Well, I'd like to take a look now, look at the Foote family from the beginning. Sheila, where did the Foote family begin?
Well, we actually met in the secular world at Ohio State University, and I had finished up school and was working a second job, and I met Rob at my second job. And at that point, I guess I learned somewhere along the line that he was going to be attending seminary and was considering the ministry. And it wasn't something that I had initially thought that I would be going in that direction. However, it has been a wonderful blessing for our family. We were married in Fort Wayne, Indiana, when Rob was attending seminary, right before he was ready to go on vicarage. And so that's sort of where the Foote family began.
So that's similar to the Ludwig family, too, as well. During the seminary time, the family begins. And so right before vicarage. So did you spend much time at the seminary then?
Actually, I was finishing up a job in Columbus and was going to be without a job. So I moved to Fort Wayne and had a job there and had the pleasure to be at the seminary occasionally, but not a lot. And then we went on vicarage and we went way out to California to a very small town, which was a little bit south of Fresno and was quite a culture shock. It had a very large Hispanic population, and which was lovely. It was a lovely area. And I worked as a substitute teacher and also worked as a bookkeeper, and I'm not a bookkeeper at all. While my husband was out doing really fun things, which I'll let him tell you about.
So what were the fun things you got to do on Vicarage?
It was an interesting call. The church was vacant. It was a smaller church. And we called the supervising pastor in a vicarage a bishop. And so my bishop was up in Fresno about half an hour away. So it was a great call because it had to do everything. It was sink or swim, and you learned very effectively filling the pulpit every Sunday and on Wednesdays. And so part of the fun was having the freedom to work with the people and shape it. Some of those things were like elder care calls, which ended up baking pies with 95-year-old ladies. That's the one story that my wife, Sheila, hangs on to. And she says, you were out there baking pies when I was working hard in the accounting office, you know? So, yeah, there were a couple of pie baking experiences, but it wasn't all baking pies that first year.
My question is, were you baking the pies or were you sampling them to make sure that they were good?
Well, that's critical. That's a critical part of the process. You don't want to be responsible for a bad pie. And so, you know, you bake the pie, you get to taste it eventually. And that's the key, yeah.
So how did that transition go? Sheila, you were working in bookkeeping, something that was totally foreign to you, but trying to find ways to support the family. How did that transition go into vicarage life? You said it was a small parish. Were you able to connect with other families? What type of support did you have while you were there?
You know, the church was a small church, and they were wonderful. They really embraced us as a young married couple and took us under their wing. We didn't have a lot of support from other pastors and their families, but I don't think that necessarily was isolating to me because we did have so much support from the congregation at that time.
It was a pretty scattered area as far as Lutheranism goes. The Central Valley of California at that time, 30 years ago, was not necessarily a very rich Lutheran place. Lots of, and just geographically, the towns are far apart. So I had a friend in Visalia, and we got to know each other, and but they're really, as I look back on it, the circuit that I served, those seven or eight churches. Our gatherings were random, and they were not social. They were theological. Wives weren't involved. Families weren't involved. And that was just the nature of the time and the place.
And that has a purpose, certainly in many ways, and serves a purpose for pastors in keeping them sharp in that sense. But we're kind of forgetting about family life and the needs there as well. So you wrap up vicarage, move back to seminary for fourth year, right? And so what was going on during fourth year with the Foote family?
Rob was studying hard, and I was working at the Lutheran home that was in Fort Wayne, Indiana at that time.
Yeah. And I actually, I've been in radio for years, and I worked at a radio station in Fort Wayne. A couple of guys started a Sunday morning program there. The commercial station had, it's like the black hole in their schedule.
Right.
So
yeah.
they said, do something.
The shift that nobody wants to work.
Right.
The shift on Sunday morning I've been there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I was working not only at seminary, but also outside the home. And it was just a really busy time. I was playing basketball and I wasn't, as a newly married couple, I wasn't spending enough time with my wife, and I can confess that sin. And, 30 years later, my wife loves me and forgives me. So that's beautiful. But I will say that it was a time when I really was focused on myself and not really on my wife and my family.
We have a question or a comment from one of our listeners from Brentley, thinking about seminary life and questions about how do you make it all work when it comes down to money and two small kids, being married with two small kids. How do you make the financial side of things work when you're in seminary? I know there are means of support. And Sheila, you mentioned you were working through the process. How did that work out for you? How did you financially make things work?
Well, we didn't have any children at the time, so we have to kind of take that out of the mix. Mm-hmm. And I also, it's my nature to be a saver, and so I actually came into the marriage with a fairly nice bank account, which we spent all on vicarage, I think. But working was, for me, a good part of being at the seminary because it gave me some contacts within our community, not just within the seminary community also. So I think it sort of opened up my world a little bit and also gave Rob the opportunity to focus on himself.
Okay, good. Carrie, you want to add to that? I know you've been through this process as well. I know you're the coordinator for PALS, but you've been through the whole seminary process with your family as well. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, when I was going to the seminary, I'm a bottom line kind of girl. I like to see how this is all going to add up, and you know, I want to see it out into the future and how this is going to make sense. And I remember talking to the financial advisor at the seminary, and he said, "You know, Carrie, sometimes you got to step out of the boat to see God really work." And I thought, wow, that's really quite a leap of faith. And I will tell you, though, we were blessed in ways that we couldn't even have begun to imagine when we came to the seminary. Times when we thought, you know, we're done. We're out of money and we still have these bills yet that we have to pay. And gifts came out of the blue and sometimes to the dollar, exactly what we needed. So there are, I will say, for somebody considering, sometimes it doesn't make sense on paper, and yet God continues to provide.
I think it's both, and you may know the statistic. I don't know it anymore. When I graduated 30 years ago, I think the average indebtedness was like $16,000. Not as many folks were second career guys with families. There was a far larger percentage that were first guys just out of college who had just transitioned right into the seminary. I know the indebtedness has increased. That's partly because of inflation, but partly because there are more second career guys who have bigger debts and bigger families to support and things like that. So,
I think the average is about 40,000.
It's not 40,000. Yeah, I knew it was bigger. I just didn't know how much bigger. So I think, you know, worker priest comes to my mind. There was never a time in my college or seminary life when I wasn't working. And that does detract from your ability to learn. I mm-hmm. mean, you work very hard. Even right now, my wife and I have just finished up our master's programs in counseling. And, you know, we're working all the time, full-time jobs. And that's the nature of the beast. At the same time, I concur with Carrie, and there were blessings that came out. Like, for example, Vicarage. Sheila and I have always believed in at least tithing. I mean, first fruits giving is wonderful, and that's really what we do, but it comes out to close to tithing or more. And so in our first year of marriage, we were kind of exploring that stewardship device. We gave 10%, and when we left, the congregation turned around and gave us a check for the exact amount that we had given all year. And so it's a way to show that first fruits giving does come back to you. You know, cast your bread upon the water and it'll return to you. And so had we only been giving a dollar a week, it would have been a smaller amount of money. But it's just those things happen. And over and over again, God has shown us that, you know, our oldest daughter was handicapped. And when we got to our first call, we needed a vehicle that was wheelchair accessible, and we didn't say anything about it. The congregation stepped up and said, "We're going to start this thing called the Jennifer Fund," and we raised enough money to pay for a big chunk of that van. So that happens over and over again.
And let's talk about that briefly. Your transition then from fourth year into parish life now, and in your first call, what does the Foote family look like as you're getting ready to make that transition? You said your oldest daughter, so
yeah, I'm gonna let Sheila start here because she was a bigger part of that story, and I.
Well, right before we left seminary, I think we discovered that I was pregnant with our oldest child, and so we moved to Pittsburgh, which is a nice big town, and we actually I grew up in Cincinnati, Rob grew up in Cleveland, so. Coming from the very small town from our vicarage and going back to a big city felt sort of good to us. And we discovered, we had a lot of complications with our oldest daughter, and she ended up with cerebral palsy, and it was good to be in that medical community. Our congregation rallied around us and were very helpful, but I think having a daughter with special needs was difficult for me on many levels because I knew that my husband's you know, primary responsibility was more to church, I think. At least I felt that way. And felt the burden of caring for a child with these special needs as a very heavy one at that time.
Yeah, and I think from a spiritual standpoint, we were talking earlier about how first-year pastors, second-year pastors feel this burden to kind of be Superman and do it all. I felt that same burden. It was an urban church in a struggling community. They had a radio ministry every week. We were on the radio live, and that was kind of exciting. But at the same time, I think God was calling me back home by giving me a special needs child and saying, you know, this is your ministry too, to your family. And so without the blessing of a handicapped daughter, I would have probably been away even more. So
it's amazing how God uses our multiple vocations to balance things out, to strengthen the family. And certainly I'm sure that set an example for the members of your congregation as well, for them to see the time and the dedication that you give to your family, that what an example that sets for them to see a husband and a father and a wife and a mother caring for their child. And obviously it turned out well when they saw that in your family when they started the Jennifer Fund, as you mentioned.
And they made some changes. I mean, it was an old building. The church was literally, when I got there, it was a great time to arrive. It was their 100th anniversary. The building was not quite 100 years old, but close to it. There was no handicap accessibility. And so over the course of the years, they built a ramp, they built a handicap accessible bathroom, a whole new family room for families to be in during the worship service so they could participate in the worship service but not be having crying kids and all those things. So again, manifold blessings from the cross or the burden of having a daughter with special needs. And you know, it God was just equipping the entire church body to newer heights.
So obviously, the support that you had, I'm sure, shaped your future and your decision to be involved with PALS. And I want to get back to that in a second. I want to talk with Carrie about the PALS. I know we briefly mentioned it at the beginning about how PALS came to be. I know Pastor Dave mentioned that. Tell us a little bit about the history of PALS, Carrie.
Well, as Dr. Lugwood had mentioned, there is a significant number of pastors who were leaving the ministry after 5 years. And our synod saw that and was concerned. There's a lot of money invested, lives invested, and so on. And in 1998, they began the PALS program. And it was supposed to be a very specific, it's not a seminary part two. This is very practical in nature, very applied learning. And it's one thing to have studied, for instance, closed communion in the seminary. And then it's a very different thing to actually apply that in your parish. And you have, we are not blank slates going in, and the congregations to which you are called are also not blank slates. We both come into a congregation with expectations, maybe preconceived expectations about what it's going to be like to be the pastor or the wife and what my role is going to be and how things are going to operate in that congregation based on our own past experiences. And they, too, have their own set of expectations. And it's where those things maybe come in conflict sometimes.
When the boxes are unpacked and you're finally getting settled in, wait, this isn't what I thought it was going to be at all.
Yeah, exactly. And you may be called to a context that's very different than anything you've ever experienced before in an entirely different geographical location than what you've grown up in. So the PALS program was set to bring together new pastors and their wives. And this is something that's different than what you see with your circuit winkles. Although, you know, we hope that your circuit winkle is functioning the way it should be and that you're getting together on a regular basis. Generally, you see it's largely the guys that are getting together. Mm-hmm. And they are coming from all kinds of different experiences, different number of years in the parish ministry. So PALS is bringing together folks that are, it's quite a homogenous group, you know, those who are dealing with the same issues at the same time. And it's also bringing together the wives who often don't have that same kind of support group that maybe the guys do, you know, with their pastors' conferences and with the circuit winkles. So this was formed, and there's a number of curriculum items that we have developed over the years that have been requested by the participants in the PALS program. It's really driven by the participants in terms of what they're going to study and talk about, what their needs are. You know, one group may be facing particular issues, and that's what they really want to get together and talk about. And another may have something entirely different. So it's really driven by the participants.
And it sounds like family life is very much so a huge part of this. And as we were talking about earlier, without a healthy family life, that really makes it hard for a pastor to do what he's given to do. And obviously it makes it hard for a pastor's wife to do the things that she's given to do and be supportive. So go ahead.
Yeah. One of the things the PALS program does is provide perspective. You know, I think when we're coming out, you don't know what is realistic. How much time should I actually be spending? How much time should I spend at a hospital visitation? How many times should I come back, you know, in person to that same person in the hospital? And so there's this gives you some perspective, what other people are doing in their congregations, your peers. And then there's also an experienced facilitator and a facilitator wife who's been through some of these negotiations themselves and can give you that kind of perspective so that you can establish and you're not burning out.
And to the Foote family, you're now involved as facilitators and PALS. How do you see that as facilitators? How do you see these things playing out?
I'm going to jump in here. I've been doing more facilitating than my wife because Sheila, actually, the group itself kind of dictates where they're going to go. And yet I had a brand new group of guys and they just needed to do a lot of, I'll use the word commiserating themselves. Now we're bringing in the wives. They're ready for that. They realize that's a critical key part of this. So I think what they have discovered is that their wives are, we've been using the word isolated all morning, their wives are probably more isolated than they are. We say that for a lot of reasons. Congregations are loving, wonderful places. They're filled with sinners and saints. And the role of a pastor's wife is this sort of ambiguous unknown. What do you do? If you do too much, you know, the criticism will be, oh, she's trying to take over. If you don't do enough, the criticism will be, oh, she's lethargic. She doesn't care. You know, she doesn't love Jesus. And to negotiate those extremes, and they're in every congregation, is harrowing. And so for the wives, in order to really feel great about the ministry, they've got to understand what niches are they gifted with and what do they want to do? And I will say hats off to my lovely wife, Sheila, who's negotiated that beautifully for all of our years of ministry. She's been, I think, just right. She's been involved, but hasn't tried to take over anything. She's been willing to lead when called upon, and she feels it's appropriate. And so I think that to have the husbands understand that is critical. And that's really, I've been leading for just a little over a year and a half, and now the group has realized that we've got to get our wives involved. And so we're scheduling our first joint meeting with the wives coming up this fall.
Good. And Sheila, with about a minute left, your thoughts on your involvement with PALS and how that plays out for wives?
Well, I'm very excited to get started with meeting with some of the wives. I think one of the things that's difficult for a pastor's wife to balance is forming a relationship. It's hard to have a close friend in the congregation because you don't know how that will affect the rest of the congregation.
Right.
So what PALS will offer for the wives is a level of support and a level of camaraderie that I think is difficult to find within your congregation. So I'm excited to be facilitating that and forming some new relationships with them.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate your time today. You guys have really just been very open about what life has been like and all those transitions for you. Carrie, before we go, with just a few seconds left, if a congregation wants to support PALS, is there a specific way or how should they go about it? If they want to make sure that PALS is strong in their congregation, is a good resource, what can they do?
I would certainly encourage them to contact their district office. Both the district and the CITED do support the PALS program. And there are certainly congregations who are less financially able to support their incoming pastors as they'd like, and other congregations that could chip in would be fantastic.
Excellent. Well, thank you all for your time today. It has been great talking with you. I appreciate you spending some time with us on Faith and Family here on KFUO. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.